show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! No shilly-shallying around. We got to get right to it. A little program announcement for the evening. We're only doing an hour show this evening simply because I got a call and we need to go down for a meeting of our local mountaintop removal opposition group. That is, of course, at 7. I haven't had to do that in a while, but I have to do it this evening. No getting around it, and my apologies. So, with that in mind, we've got an hour of program in front of us here in which you are welcome to participate, albeit briefly. And if something should happen that I get back before the show would ordinarily end, which is unlikely, if there's enough time remaining, I'll try to get back on the air. No promises on that, though. Where to go this evening? Well, I mentioned something last night. And I'd like to kind of go at it right off the bat, because I did mention it last night. And it goes in line. You know, I don't get to things, and it's not intentional. And then, lo and behold, something comes along, and it is as if the universe has said, Bob, you held that for a reason. We've got a follow-up. So there's a follow-up to this as well. At any rate, the issue of metallurgical coal. My, how not exciting that is. But it actually is more exciting than you might think. Because it actually has more to do with where we stand in Appalachia and where we stand nationally. The issue of metallurgical coal has everything to do with whether or not we have that green economy that we seem to that we keep talking about but seem to have such a hard time kick-starting. You might recall that, for instance, wind turbines are made of steel. The question of who will make the steel for those wind turbines and where those wind turbines will be made is of utmost gravity as we contemplate the coming green economy and the transition away from some of the filthier aspects of the 19th century economy that we have so desperately clung to. So this, and this was sent to me by News Ninja Gene, the guy who reads the entire internet every day. Honest to Pete, he does. He doesn't miss anything. Check this out. I mean, just see where this goes for you. China's $680 billion stimulus is boosting the economy faster than many Westerners expected. This from Seeking Alpha. Quarter three gross domestic product, or in econ speak, Q3 GDP, was 8.9% on an annual basis. That's hot. It was reported that China may reach double-digit growth in Q4 as the stimulus kicks into full speed. The second largest economy in the world may reach self-sustainability in 2010. The G20 meeting over the weekend confirmed that stimulus around the globe will remain intact until 2011. As a result, demand for raw materials will pick up quickly both in China and here in the U.S. Following on that notion, one of the materials that is strong in demand, or that is in strong demand, is metallurgical coal. Part of the reason for that is China doesn't produce enough high-quality metallurgical coal, and the domestic production is really low volume, and it depends on import from Australia and U.S. to meet its demand. High-quality steel products need high-quality metallurgical coal. Earlier this year, China's Chinalco, not to be confused with the brand of tequila that our good friend Bart Kopp so reveres, Chinalco. No, China's Chinalco tried to take over a stake in Rio Tinto to lock the supply of iron ore and metallurgical coal from Australia. But the deal didn't go through when Rio Tinto turned to BP for help on its funding shortage. Now, even that, in the Rio Tinto story is a program in itself, and I'm sure John followed some of that as well. So it is no surprise to see China widen its search to the West. There are high-quality metallurgical coal producers in the U.S., most of them exporting to China. So China is depending on these companies for supply. Alpha Natural Resources, Massey Energy, and BP PLC are all seeing strong demand from China well into 2010. Alpha Natural Resources is particularly interesting. And now the question. And it's a question not just for econ wonks or stock watchers. It's a question for people in the United States. For people in Appalachia trying to stay alive in proximity to King Coal. And the question is this. Can any Chinese company take a stake in these companies to lock in metallurgical coal supply for the nation? We will see. President Obama's visit to China may shed some light on how the two nations can promote free trade to jumpstart the global recovery. Ew. Just ew. Free trade? Free trade with China? Who here, remembering that I have that special romper room power where I can see hands go up, who here thinks that what goes on between the United States and China is free trade? Anybody? Anybody? Bueller. 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 No! Now, it was just last week. I believe it was precisely a week ago that we discussed the fact that the wingnuts are gearing up to oppose a bill in the Congress that would limit or attempt to limit China's disgusting ongoing use of slave and child labor in its manufacturing processes. Right? Yeah. And I noted that, you know, the backstory that David Sirota really didn't highlight it is the fact that if it's something you need to stop, that means it's something that's already going on. Free trade with China? I beg to differ. There is no free trade with China. Ask Leo Girard, the president of the steelworkers. He'll tell you all you ever wanted to know and more about so-called free trade with China. I have mentioned time and again, and it is a fact, that American corporations seeking to do business in China have to enter incredibly restrictive agreements that state that 80% of everything that they make in China for the first 5 years will be made for export to us, the U.S., and elsewhere to a certain extent, but mainly to the U.S., and that technological innovations must be turned over to the dictatorial, fascistic Chinese government. So that then Chinese state-owned businesses can use those innovations to crush the American businesses doing business in China. Flummoxes me. All these Wall Street geniuses and Harvard MBA holding economic accounting principled wild men who run these giant corporations and they're volunteering to get it dry and sideways from the Chinese government for a short-term profit? Well, you know, granted, yes, of course, it's not very good for the working people, but after all, whoever gave a rat's rear end about the working people? Oh, please. I'm going to come away from this 5-year deal so filthy, stinking rich that if I start burning $100 bills by the $1,000 sheafful every day for the next 100 years, I'll still be rich. That's how that works. But metallurgical coal. Metallurgical coal is rarer than so-called steam coal, which is practically lignite, just short of being flammable brown mud, a step perhaps above tar sands, or sideways, perhaps, depending on how you view it. Metallurgical coal means something. You go into that kitchen drawer you got there where you keep all the sharp stuff, and if you've got one of those fancy schmancy knives, and if you're a cooking geek, you do. And if you look along perhaps the edge of the blade, you might see three words: high carbon steel. High-carbon steel is good steel for applications such as cutlery, and I'm sure many others. Well, high-carbon steel refers to coal. Coal is carbon. Can't make decent steel without it. And reserves of metallurgical coal are limited. Going down the mountain here where I live, there is a big sign in front of a coal operation that I do believe is run by Massey Energy. It says, "This mine produces some of the finest metallurgical steel in the world." And it very well may. But my question is, if we are to manufacture our own wind turbines, if we are to rebuild a green economy, then metallurgical coal will be a significant part of that process, for there must be steel in order for there to be wind turbines and oh so many other things. You know, we saw recently what it costs us. What it costs us to use cheap Chinese garbage steel. We saw it on the Oakland Bay Bridge, where huge chunks of the stuff simply gave out and gave way shortly after having been installed, because it was cheap garbage Chinese steel. Not American steel made to American specs. I don't mean this to sound xenophobic or anything like that, but the fact of the matter is, it was way more than a year ago, because he's been gone for a year now, that our good friend Kenny Bollies, who went by Clyde at WD40.com and was a master welding inspector, sent me a heads up about cheap garbage Chinese steel being used for high-pressure steam lines. He sent me photographs of what one of those steam lines looks like when they rupture. And dog knows, when one of those things ruptures, if there's a human being near it, that human being becomes a cooked human being. It was only through some act of fortunate random chance that someone didn't get killed on the Bay Bridge when that cheap Chinese garbage steel gave out. And I know that organizations like the United Steelworkers and like the Alliance for American Manufacturing are very much at the forefront of trying to talk to America about the importance of steel in the resurgence of the American economy. The Alliance for American Manufacturing, among other things, points out that steel making techniques in this country are far greener and far cleaner than what goes on in those steel mills in China. And why wouldn't they be? The people making steel in the United States aren't chained, don't have a chain in a bolt driven into a taproom floor. They aren't slaves. The world's second largest economy, which this article notes may become self-sustainable by 2010, and I'm not sure quite what kind of metric they're using to define self-sustainable, operates on a concept of involuntary human servitude, operates on a concept of human bondage, operates on a concept that we spent 5 years blowing ourselves to pieces to end. And yet our economic betters, the masters of the economy, say that they want us to cast aside our morals, our ethics, in some cases, our religious faith, and just get what we get from a slave country. And I don't know about you, that's not all right with me. It is a horror to me. It is a horror to me that the blood of whose victims cries out from the ground, as did that of Abel of old. And the very linchpin to all of it is metallurgical coal. Of course, Massey Energy would be, naturally, a big supplier to that slave nation. After all, back in the 80s, when no one with any ethics, morals, or conscience would do business with the apartheid regime in South Africa, Don Blankenship said, "We will!" And of course, there was, how about that? Slave labor there too. And it's horrifying. Well, like I said, sometimes stories don't get used and they get followed up whether I want it or not. And so what did I open my inbox this morning to find? Why, it's a special to the congressional newspaper Roll Call. And staring back at me off of the monitor screen is nothing other than that bulbous head, those beady little rodentine eyes, and that sleazy, pimpish paper, the pencil-thin mustache of none other than Donnie Blankenship, who apparently has someone on the payroll who can write for him, and writes as follows. During his state visit to China, President Barack Obama must seize the moment and persuade Chinese leaders to address the nation's environmental problems. I know. Get up off the floor. Yeah, you... Yeah, because God knows we can't address the environmental problems that this piece of shit creates here in the United States. Oh, did I just call him that? Oh, my inner monologue got loose. Bad. Bad, Bob. Bad! China's environmental record not only threatens the health and welfare of its chitterns, especially the ones that are chained to the tables, but also encourages greedy international corporations to close their factories at home and produce more cars, chemicals, and steel in Asia. Irony is completely lost on this guy. Greedy international corporations? Really? Did you just type that? With your little right index finger and your little left index finger and staring with those beady little rat eyes at the keyboard, Don Blankenship, did you really type greedy international corporations? Really? Let me be blunt. The president should not lecture the Chinese about global warming. China faces too many real environmental dangers to waste time on a hoax like climate change. Shh. Don't tell Don. But for all of their slave labor stuff, the Chinese take global warming quite seriously because they see its impact on their country. There's a, again, don't tell Don, there's a damn dust cloud that blows from west to east across the Pacific that's visible from space. Meanwhile, the heavy metals and toxic materials unleashed by Chinese factories that lack even the most basic environmental safeguards pose a clear and present danger to millions of Chinese, especially Chirins. Air pollution alone causes more than 300,000 premature deaths a year in China. Funny how he gets the memo about China, but he hasn't heard about the air pollution deaths that are caused in the United States from the damnable coal that he gets out of blown-up mountains in Appalachia. Don't that just beat cats? We must encourage Obama to deliver a no-nonsense message to President Hu Jintao and other leaders. And I just said in other leaders because, well, I got a list of them here and I can't eat. And just typing them makes my index fingers, thinking about typing them makes my index fingers ache. China and other developing nations should adopt basic environmental protections similar to the Clean Air Act provisions that the United States enacted in the 1970s. Despite the costs, U.S. industry compliance with the Clean Air Act has essentially eliminated the health hazards posed by some dangerous pollutants, including lead, particulates, soot, and sulfur dioxide. Don? Mercury? Selenium? Oh, them ain't pollutants. You can get vitamins with selenium in them. It's got to be good for you. In our country, industry environmental efforts and cleaner cars... See, that's because they got them vacuum cleaners there at the U-Wash at Car Wash, and you just put a quarter in it, and it just cleans that, and you get a cleaner car. Have benefited our workers, our communities, and our children. Our nationwide air quality, as measured by the levels of the six air pollutants that must meet national standards, has improved significantly. From 1980 to 2008, air pollution from ozone dropped 25%, even if I don't believe in no ozone. Particulates by 68%, particularly. Nitrogen dioxide by 46%. I always giggle when I write nitrogen dioxide, because that's your laughing gas. Sulfur dioxide by 71%. Carbon monoxide by 79%. And lead by 92%, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. And don't you dare mention the fact that I didn't mention carbon dioxide, because everybody knows it ain't a pollutant. It's goddamn natural. And if it wasn't natural, it wouldn't be in this here beer I've been swilling the whole time I've been typing this crazy crap. U.S. industry cleanup efforts have also contributed to declines in toxic air pollutants like benzene, mercury, and other chemicals, even though the mercury that's been cleaned up didn't come from no coal. And stop saying that, you greeniac communists. The operators of U.S. chemical plants, incinerators, and coke ovens have spent millions and millions of dollars to reduce emissions of the worst pollutants, and EPA data show these efforts have produced the desired results. These efforts were expensive, but U.S. companies invested the money to improve the air we breathe. Long as it ain't air in Appalachia. Now it's China's turn to ensure its future by protecting its children. Not necessarily by unleashing them from the tables that they're chained to and the various and other sundry other places that Chinese churins are forced to be little slaves so I can make another couple of million dollars selling metallurgical coal to China. Not that kind of well-being. No. Nah, we don't even want to be doing that kind of protecting of children. I mean, my God, there's billions of them. If China and other developing nations followed America's lead and adopted tougher clean air standards, the environmental benefits for their citizens would be immense. Importantly, these new environmental protections would also create a level playing field for U.S. businesses that have complied with basic clean air requirements for decades. Now, there won't be any level playing field, Don, until those aforementioned slaves are actually allowed to have a say-so in, you know, their working conditions. And whether they work where they work. But, you know, they're just Chinese, right, Don? American industries could no longer avoid U.S. environmental laws by closing their factories here and exporting those jobs to China. Poor Don doesn't even understand the half of it. He don't know about the little backroom deals with the 5 years and the 80% and all of that crap. No, Don's, this is all just sort of, oh, horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, where are you when I need you? This is that sort of denial kind of said, dear diary, I wish the Chinese would be more environmental like me. Who? China and other fast developing nations must do what's right for the people. And what's fair to other countries? We have no problem with China's reluctance to join Europe and the U.S. in a misguided battle against global warming. If the U.S. wants to commit economic suicide and export hundreds of thousands of high-paying manufacturing jobs overseas, why blame China for our stupidity? We can all appreciate China's stated priority, first development, then environment. But see, that's not how they're operating over there. They really don't know. They're not. It's a miserable fascist the economy that runs on slaves. But it's not. That's not the philosophy. Growth delivers huge benefits for people, starting with better health, more food. Oh, look, 2 grains of rice for dinner. We're in the money. More food and running water. Never mind that the water runs black, but nothing improves people's lives like electricity. Yeah. He said that. Now, never mind the fact that if you've got electricity but you don't have clean water, the electricity's not worth a damn. Never mind the fact that if you can't breathe, the electricity don't count for much. Nothing improves people's lives like electricity. Oddly enough, my rural forebears tended to live up into their 90s and their 100s, and they didn't have no electricity. But they did have clean air and water. Go figure. But China plays by its own rules. Its economic miracle depends too much on inadequate environmental protections that put its children at risk. That's why tougher clean air regulation is needed in China, which is home to 16 of the world's 20 dirtiest cities. China's leaders understand the problem. In October, a top Chinese environmental official admitted that one-fifth of the nation's drinking water failed to meet national standards, leaving 90 million people without access to clean water. I wonder how many people are without access to clean water in West Virginia, and Don had a hand in that. Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, pot, kettle, you guys know each other? Do you? Lead poisoning is perhaps China's most lethal environmental problem, and one that is particularly harmful to children. For many times, they will eat lead paint chips thinking they are food, because they do not have much of that in the factories where they are chained to the tables. No, I added that part. Last month, more than 1,000 children under age 14 in Henan province in central China tested positive for dangerous levels of lead in their blood, almost certainly the result of unchecked lead emissions from the nation's largest lead smelter located nearby. Oh, my God. I can't stand it. I'm going to have a fit. I'm going to have a plum conniption. Here's Don Blankenship worried about industrial pollution and children. And you know, I'm not discounting the issue. There's a filthy old lead smelter in Henan province, and it's I read about this, and it's poisoning the children there. But who are they making the lead for? Who are they smelting the lead for? Where's the lead going after it's been smelted? Hint! It ain't all staying in China, and it ain't all fishing weights. It's coming here. Because there's still need for lead. But the idea of Don Blankenswine being concerned about Chinese children when he has been engaged for years in actively poisoning Appalachian children is something that is almost beyond my ability to process. Where is this going? This incident followed accounts of lead poisoning in Shanxi province and elsewhere in China, affecting thousands of children. Fair trade and human health concerns. Notice the fair trade part comes first. Demand that China solve its environmental problems by enacting and enforcing more stringent clean air rules. Obama should insist that China improve its environmental laws and worry about global warming when and if it becomes something more than a theory. So in other words, President Obama needs to pluck the mote out of China's eye without noting the cold-colored beam in our own. Screw them Appalachian cherubs. Sometimes, I mean, I'm not doing any suffering here. But I get up in the morning and I read stuff like that, and you remember the old comic routine where the guy's sitting at the bar and he watches Samantha the Witch just appear and disappear, and he takes the hip flask out and throws it over his shoulder? That's my morning sometimes. Not that I got a hip flask in the morning, but it's just like, with the coffee cup, screw it, I'm done, and I'm out the door and take a walk. So, what we have here is a pitch for everybody to look at the birdie over here in the left hand, while Communist Don, yeah, I just called him a communist, but they're not communists in China either. They're fascists, and so is he. You know, that dirty little bastard was born here. He is an Appalachian person. And he is doing everything he can to destroy the lives of thousands upon thousands of Appalachian people while complaining about how China treats its chirons. It's almost more than I can stand. I'm almost glad there's only 25 minutes left of tonight's show. Because there's an urge to just begin a sort of economic Tourette's that just makes me power swear for the next 2.5 hours, and that's not good radio under any circumstances. This in from Andy in New Jersey. Bob, you are spot on with the one-way free trade street we have going on with China. This isn't trade. It's the raping and pillaging of Nanking, but in America. We have a trade deficit every quarter from $25 billion to $35 billion with China. Since 2000, the deficit has grown to roughly around $1 trillion. This is so insane. The elite have sold out America to China. China doesn't buy our goods. Wall Street has gutted America so they can make money on Chinese investments by abusing and exploiting low-cost Chinese labor. In addition to lax environmental laws, Wall Street and our corrupt politicians completely sold out our middle and working class. The raping of Nanking is happening here against our middle class. It's attack the middle class all day, every day, through the tidal wave of Chinese goods inundating our nation, destroying our industrial base. Bob, why do they do this to us? And it's just a long string of dollar signs. And of course, that is why they do it to us. I mean, I'm accustomed to irony and everything, but when I got up this morning and saw the Don Blankenship thing, it was like, this might be a little too much irony. This might be a little bit more than that, but thankfully, no, because I realized that it sort of went hand in glove with the metallurgical coal story, which is, I mean, coal is filthy. There's no way to burn it right. There's no way to burn it well. There's no way to burn it cleanly. Coal is filthy. But where metallurgical coal is concerned, if we want steel, we're going to, and until we find some other thing that will replace the carbon in coal in the steel-making process, we're going to have to deal with it. And to give the devil his due, the fact of the matter is, American steel manufacturers are better at it than their Chinese counterparts. Now, pissants like Don Blankenship go hammer and tongs day and night hollering about how coal is a part of our national security future. And yet they load that national security future on a slow boat to China day in and day out, because you will recall that the article noted that demand, even though the rest of the economy and the coal economy especially has gone to crap, that the demand for coal remains strong. What would Don Blankenship do if China tried to buy up Massey? Is that why he wrote this essay, to try to make sure that his potential Chinese masters might not be interested in Massey? Remember, Massey only exists via the massive infusions of capital from, I think, one remaining bank, J.P. Morgan Chase? Is that it? Because most of the other major Wall Street funder banks have gotten out of the coal business and gotten out of the mountaintop removal business. So Don's probably getting a little bit nervous. Ni hao, Don. Ni hao. Don, how would you like to go live in one of those 16 dirtiest cities in the world, buddy? Because when you do business with the fascist regime in China, sooner or later, you're going to wind up being commanded by them. And let's be clear about why I call it a fascist regime. The man who invented fascism, Benito Mussolini, said that fascism should be defined as the marriage of the powers of the state with the powers of business. Isn't that what we've got now that we've brought free trade freedom to China and they've turned it into a monster? Hasn't the vast power of the Chinese government become wedded to corporate power that we have infused from the United States of America? Such that they now hold absolutely horrifying levels of our national debt and could crush us like a bug in an instant? I have great reverence and great respect for the Chinese people, all of its varied peoples, and an amazing and stunning history that continues to present lessons for us all. But if you study the Chinese dynasties, you will find that some were better and some were worse, and some were incredibly repressive. This is not the first incredibly repressive regime to hold sway on the Asian mainland. And it is that sort of government that I hold in the highest disdain and the highest dishonor. And because we have abandoned the human rights position that we were once able at least somewhat to stake out, and we have abandoned it in the name of getting Chinese money into the American economy to prop up tottering financial edifices and provide supports for fragile balloon economies. It is because of this that Barack Obama, no matter how much the issue may mean to him personally, Barack Obama cannot go to China and look at Hu Jintao and say, listen, not another damn dime. Not another company comes here until your people are free. Not another dime crosses the Pacific until Tibet is free. Because as much as we may not want to admit it, our president, the president of the United States, Barack Obama, whom I do sincerely to believe to be, and I know how dangerous the word believe is, but I do believe him to be a compassionate man, a man of some decent philosophy. But he has already been warned by the financial geniuses not to piss off our Chinese masters. And so the most that he can do is sit and speak to some Chinese student in Shanghai yesterday and tell them, we really want you to have a better internet connection. We want, the American people want you to be able to Facebook and tweet. And that constitutes the stern tongue lashing on human rights
of a nation that tramples its people and enslaves its own children. Jesus! We bombed Iraq for less. He's a brutal dictator who gasses his own people. What would George Bush say about a nation that enslaves its babies? Or I'm told it's good for business. Never mind. Look away. You did not see the enslaved children. Those were not enslaved children you saw there. That was the economic engine of the world. The economic engine of the world is oiled with the blood of child labor. And it's sickening. And Don Blankenship can't be bothered to mention it. Because he's in a delicate little situation, isn't he? He doesn't want to become one of those slaves himself, no matter how well paid. But by the same token, he damn sure doesn't want the Chinese looking somewhere else for their metallurgical coal, because, baby, that's good for Don Blankenship. If he could just get the industry cleaned up over there, he would do everything in his power to send every last lump of American national security metallurgical coal to China for another dollar. Or yuan, as the case may be. The horror of the economic trade out that we make when we decide that dollars are more important than children, whether they be hillbilly children or Appalachian children. And the blasting proceeds apace all over Appalachia. And I suppose this is rhetorical, but the question is, can you tolerate that? Will you tolerate that? Don Blankenship wants to save the little Chinese children. But from what? He is shipping to them daily by boatload the very thing that is doing among the worst of the poisoning. Hard to stomach. So we're about 12 minutes before the hour. And that leaves us little time for other serious topics. But I thought I thought you might find this little bit interesting. Totally separate topic. There has been, in the last couple of days, a new meme taking hold. And it is a continuation of Dick Cheney's dithering criticism. David Broder, supposedly a liberal at the Washington Post, wrote the following. This from Nicole Bell over at Crooks and Liars. The more President Obama examines our options in Afghanistan, the less he likes the choices he sees. But as the old saying goes, to govern is to choose, and he has stretched the internal debate to the breaking point. It is evident from the length of this deliberative process and from the flood of leaks that have emerged from Kabul and Washington that the perfect course of action does not exist, Given that reality, the urgent necessity is to make a decision whether or not it is right. How is that? David Broder got paid to write that? This guy is deemed the dean of Beltway journalism. Man, he's the guy. Do something, even if it isn't right. And then this. From Mark Shields, in regard to the decision process of President Obama. A show called Inside Washington, discussing the Afghanistan decision, you get this exchange. Now, I would say, just please pay attention, because there's a quiz after.
Flummoxed by it, and there are some leaks, there are always leaks. Whatever answer he's going to come up with, it's going to be unsatisfactory.
I don't remember an administration where they didn't try to stop leaks, and nobody ever succeeded that I know of.
No, but I think that what we have here is something quite different. We have a president of real intellectual horsepower, who's cool, detached, and analytical. And if anything, you can watch the emotional side of them emerge in this whole process. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw it at Arlington. We saw it at Fort Hood. We saw it at Dover Air Force Base. There's an emotional aspect. The Comforter-in-Chief as well as the Commander-in-Chief, both roles. And I think, it makes me nostalgic for those days when we had a manly man in the White House who could say, let's kick some tail and ask questions afterwards, you know? That's what we really need instead of any reflection.
So, here's the question. Was that offered seriously?
Let's kick some tail and ask questions after.
Well, it sounded serious to me. Now, there was one little weird hoot on the panel that I think probably came from, one of the liberals. But now, Shields has insisted that he was being sarcastic. Thank God he didn't say he was taken out of context. I get so tired of the, no, you're certainly out of context. Well, there's the context. See, and that's, that's why there are emoticons in email. That's why in chat rooms, you type the little colon followed by the little close paren for a little sideways smiley face so people can understand the intent of what you are saying, because otherwise it can be seriously misinterpreted. But he was being sarcastic. On the other hand, the editor emeritus of the Washington Times, Wesley Pruden, was not being sarcastic when he lit into President Obama for having the temerity to display decent manners in meeting the Emperor of Japan and his wife, the Empress. Writing in the Mooney Times today, Wesley Pruden, who depends on his paycheck, he depends on his ability to be fawning and wing nuttish, because after all, his paycheck comes straight from Reverend Moon, and we won't go through the Mooney wedding ceremony again with all the sacred handkerchiefs. I just don't have the stomach for it. He wrote, "But Mr. Obama, unlike his predecessors, likely knows no better, and many of those around him, true children of the grungy 60s, are contemptuous of custom. Cutting America down to size is what attracts them to hope for change. It's no fault of the president
that he has no natural instinct or blood impulse for what the America of the 57 states is about. He was sired by a Kenyan father, born to a mother attracted to men of the third world, and reared by grandparents in Hawaii, the paradise far from the American mainstream.
Jeebus. It's another one of those time travel moments that really got written in 2010.
He's a true children of the grungy 60s. I don't know what happened to my America. 3 pairs of Brooks Brothers shoes, 7 identical blue shirts, matching club rep ties, and a navy blue blazer and a pair of well-starched trousers should be enough for any American. And that mother of his, with her sick, disgusting fascination with third world men. Filthy third world men of dark complexion who seek to come here and ruin all that is white and good about America. It sickens me. Bring me another baby to eat.
Beam, meet Moat. David Broder, meet Mr. Prudence. Mr. Prudence, Mr. Broder. Mr. Broder, Mr. Prudence. Now we've got enough for bridge. Well, I don't know how to end the hour on that. This is the part where ordinarily I would solicit phone calls. But I shan't be doing that. I think I've got to cough up a hairball. No, I've got a meeting to attend. My apologies. I'll start the rerun of last night's show if you haven't heard it for the 15th time so far. And if we do get back before 9 o'clock, I'll crank up some more show. KK? Good. So, thanks, everybody. For an hour, it's been real. We'll talk soon. Remember, prayer meeting's tomorrow night. Get your prayer hankies out. Be ready. Neither the minute nor the hour is appointed. Well, yes, it is. 6 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow night. Thanks, everybody. Here comes the rerun.
Cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Monday. Beautiful Monday. Merciful Monday. Monday has arrived. It's another brand new week of liberal media on the horn.
Now, aren't you happy? I'm happy. Of course, last night was something very, very special. Ferg and I enjoyed an absolutely magnificent time down in Charleston. Him getting his first rock concert. Me, my first trucker show in myself. Had a lovely conversation with Patterson Hood after the show. And Ferg was on something that you've heard of. You know, well, he was on Cloud 9. No, no, no. Ferg was on something that takes a lot more than simple math to calculate. And he and I will talk about it here in a little bit. We've also got something that I hope is going to work out and happen coming up about the bottom of the hour. And that is that we've got a guest coming along. And it's going to be one of those little groundbreaking international conversations that we've become so fond of. We're going to be joined at the bottom of the hour by Chi Soon Wan. Chi Soon Wan is a political dissident in one of the harshest, most repressive regimes on earth, namely Singapore. Of course, President Obama just recently further legitimized Singapore's repression by attending the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit there. And I really do have to thank the Singaporeans for not putting President Obama in a pagliacci suit or the little dotted pajamas that somebody put George Bush in. These were simply little silk tunics of varying muted colors, and it's, well, I'm just grateful. But that's about as far as my gratitude extends. Singapore is a magnificent place, a beautiful place, an amazing food culture, a culture that represents a emerging and amalgam of just about all the, well, it's kind of a crossroads for all the ethnicities of the Asian region. And in that place, there is a government as repressive, as I said, as any on the planet. Chi Soon Wan has been jailed frequently. He has been harassed. He has been driven into bankruptcy. All because he had the unmitigated gall to challenge the ruling elite and its leader, Lee Kuan Yew. Now, by the way, Lee Kuan Yew was recently welcomed into the Oval Office. Let's see. Who agrees with me? Well, let's see. Amnesty International does. The legal system there has been condemned by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch. And if you can imagine, because of the fact that he dares to criticize the government, Chi Soon Wan is not allowed to leave the country. If you say something bad about the government in Singapore, you are sued for defamation and driven into bankruptcy. As Chi Soon Wan and his Singapore Democratic Party have been done. Among other things, it has been said that this climate continues to stifle freedom of expression, deters the expression of views alternative to those of the ruling People's Action Party, and dissuades many Singaporeans from exercising their right to take part in public affairs. This is, this is less than inspiring, and I rather wish that we wouldn't legitimize it. Because, you know, we had 8 years, did we not? 8 tormented, tortured, agonizing, misspent years of the Bush administration running brutally around the planet, supporting dictatorships, supporting repressive regimes. Wouldn't it be good to sort of turn that around? I mean, just saying. But no, they were legitimized. Eh. I hate that. Something else that came out of, and this is distressing, something else that came out of the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit meeting. We've decided to punt on climate change. Let's see. Yesterday, in the NFL, New England coach Bill Belichick decided not to punt, and it cost him. There are times you should punt. But we have decided, when we ought not, to punt on climate change. The language specifically from the New York Times is as follows, Dateline Singapore. President Obama and other world leaders have decided to put off the difficult task of reaching a climate change agreement at a global climate conference scheduled for next month, agreeing instead, oh, those insteads, those are the ones that bite you in the ass, aren't they? Instead, to make it the mission of the Copenhagen conference, Copenhagen, to reach a less specific, politically binding agreement that would punt the most difficult issues into the future. See, I didn't say punt. They said punt. And that's the New York Times. A less specific, politically binding agreement that would punt the most difficult issues into the future. Apparently, there was a hastily organized breakfast there at the APEC summit Sunday morning. And it was attended by folks like Lars Loke Rasmussen, the Prime Minister of Denmark, and the chairman of the climate conference in Copenhagen. And he and others agreed that in order to salvage the meeting at Copenhagen, my God, it's still 2 or 3 weeks away, and they're already salvaging it. It hasn't even happened yet, and it's already getting salvaged. Wow! Am I the only one that finds that a little bit off-putting? That it hasn't started and it's got to be salvaged? Gee, I wonder who's tanking it. Oh, wait. Oh. This just in. That's us. We're tanking it. The Tom Coburns and the Jim Inhofes and the Robert Byrds and the John Rockefellers and the chinless Mitch McConnells and the Jim Demented's and the people out there, well, you know, and the Joe Liebermans. You know, because remember, Joe Lieberman doesn't want us to have health care, doesn't want every American to be able to go to the doctor, because he's afraid it'll ruin the economic recovery. So too, I suppose, with climate change legislation. And we can't have all these green jobs popping up everywhere and ruining the economy. So as it turns out, they have already said, as of yesterday, Sunday, that the world can wait a few more months to begin getting more serious about the persistent and constant threat to the continued existence of life on Earth. Yeah, I know. Doesn't do me any good either. Imagine that. The language of the article? They would have to push a fully binding legal agreement down the road, possibly to a second summit meeting in Mexico City later on. Well, I suppose there's a little bit of ironic goodness in that. Mexico City is one of the most polluted places on planet Earth. The smog in Mexico City is god-awful, to say the least. Because it sits in the Valley of Mexico, in Quemanahuac, in the heart of the one world, as the people who raised the most brilliant civilization in existence at the time on the entire planet in that valley of Mexico. They called it the heart of the one world. They lived sustainably, of course, and more brilliantly than their nose-picking, butt-scratching European conquerors. The hillsides surrounding Mexico City were forested. A magnificent lake flowed or sat in the area that provided a tremendous, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, civilization, city civilization, with food, with water. They dealt with their waste issues. And they fed their people better than anybody else on the planet at the time, except for other cultures there in the Americas. The Spaniards came in, chopped down all the trees, dried up the lake. Lake Texcoco, by the way. And began turning it into a hellhole. And it is indeed that now. As much as I would, oh God, I can't begin to tell you how I'd love to go down and see the antiquities of Mesoamerica. It really is high on the bucket list, so to speak. But that's where we will find out if we're going to get serious about climate change, is in a city that was is an absolute microcosm of man's ability to change climate and to change for the worse his and her surroundings. Michael Froman is the Deputy National Security Advisor for the International Economic Affairs. He said there was an assessment by the leaders that it is unrealistic to expect a full internationally legally binding agreement could be negotiated between now and Copenhagen, which starts in 22 days. I don't think the negotiations have proceeded in such a way that any of the leaders thought it was likely that we were going to achieve the final agreement in Copenhagen, and yet thought that it was important that Copenhagen be an important step forward, including with international impact. And we can't reach that agreement because of, again, just saying, us. Oh, what was it that was said by some bizarre, sick, twisted, pudding-brained right-winger some time back? Maybe it was Michelle Bachmann. With that many adjectives, it kind of has to have been. The climate will be fine. God will protect it. Yeah. Oh, and speaking of which, of course, Godzilla from Wasilla's new book is out, otherwise known as Bible Spice, otherwise known as Sarah Palin, going rogue. And it's just, it's just chock-a-block with comedic goodness. It's astonishingly bad. And, you know, among other things, she makes clear, yeah, stop the presses for this one, that she does not believe in evolution. Yeah, I know, hard to imagine, isn't it? She says, she talks about creationism and says, she didn't believe in the theory that human beings, thinking, loving beings, originated from fish that sprouted legs and crawled out of the sea, don't you know, or from monkeys who eventually swung down out from the trees, golly darn, gosh, gee willikers. Yeah, no evolution. Sarah, well, I can't stand to ever miss an opportunity to run the official prophet of the Head On Radio Network. So, Sarah Palin, this is for you.
Fundamentalist Christianity, fascinating. These people actually believe that the world is 12,000 years old. Swear to God. Based on what? I asked them. Well, we looked at all the people in the Bible and we added them up all the way back to Adam and Eve, their ages, 12,000 years. Well, how fucking scientific. Okay. I didn't know that you'd gone to so much trouble there. That's good. You believe the world's 12,000 years old?
That's right.
Okay, I got one word to ask you. One word question. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Dinosaur. You know, the world's 12,000 years old, and dinosaurs existed, and they existed in that time. You think it would have been mentioned in the fucking Bible at some point. And oh, Jesus and the disciples walked to Nazareth, but the trail was blocked by a giant brontosaurus with a splinter in his paw. And oh, the disciples did run a-shrieking, "What a big fucking lizard, Lord!" But Jesus was unafraid, and he took the splinter from the brontosaurus' paw, and the big lizard became his friend. And Jesus sent him to Scotland, where he lived in a lock for oh so many years, inviting thousands of American tourists to bring their fat fucking families and their fat dollar bills. And oh, Scotland did praise the Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord.
But get this, I actually asked one of these guys, okay, dinosaur fossils, how does that fit into your scheme of life? Let me sit down and strap in. He says, dinosaur fossils, God put those here to test our faith. Thank God I'm strapped in right now here, man. I think God put you here to test my faith, dude. You believe that?
Yeah, so Sarah Palin, that's it. Sarah Palin has been put here to test our faith, and we're all strapped in, right? Right. I hope so. I hope so. And then there's this, as we cruise toward the bottom of the hour in our conversation with Chi-Sun Won, which I hope will happen. Then there's this. I want to share something with you. It is from The Onion. And all of us being rational sorts of people, we understand that The Onion is satire and humor and really, really funny sometimes. But I'm honestly afraid that The Onion's going to go out of business. David in Tennessee sent this along to me and said, I would think seriously about reading this on the air. And, yeah, after I was done, I was like, how do I not? Because I've got a story to juxtapose this with that sort of, I don't know, maybe it'll make clear why I'm afraid that The Onion's going to go out of business. And my thesis being that right-wing the bizarre, twisted sickness, it's becoming more and more difficult, as I have asserted on this program in times past, becoming more and more difficult to ascertain the difference between satire and reality. And we have no one other than the right wing to thank for that. Hence this. Headline, Area Man Passionate Defender of What He Imagines Constitution to Be. Spurred by an administration he believes to be guilty of numerous transgressions, self-described American patriot Kyle Mortensen, 47, is a vehement defender of ideas he seems to think are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution and principles that brave men have fought for and died for solely in his head. Our very way of life is under siege, said Mortensen, whose understanding of the Constitution derives not from a close reading of the document, but from talk show pundits, books by television personalities, and the limitless expanse of his own colorful imagination. It's time for true Americans to stand up and protect the values that make us who we are. According to Mortensen, an otherwise mild-mannered husband, father, and small business owner, the most serious threat to his fanciful version of the 222-year-old Constitution is the attempt by far-left traitors to strip it of its religious foundation. Right there in the preamble, the authors make their priorities clear. One nation under God,
said Mortensen, attributing to the Constitution a line from the Pledge of Allegiance, which itself did not include any reference to a deity until 1954. Well, there's a reason they put that right there at the top. Men like Madison and Jefferson were moved by the ideals of Christianity and wanted the United States to reflect those values as a Christian nation, continued Mortensen, referring to the father of the Constitution, James Madison, considered by many historians to be an atheist, and Thomas Jefferson, an Enlightenment-era thinker who rejected the divinity of Christ and was in France at the time the document was written. The words on the page speak for themselves. According to sources who have read the nation's charter, the U.S. Constitution and its 27 amendments do not contain the word God or Christ. Mortensen said his admiration for the loose assemblage of vague half-notions he calls the Constitution has only grown over time. He believes that each detail he has pulled from thin air, from prohibitions on sodomy and flag burning to mandatory crackdowns on immigrants to the right of citizens not to have their hard-earned income confiscated in the form of taxes, has contributed to making it the best framework for governance since the Ten Commandments. And let's not forget that when the Constitution was ratified, it brought freedoms to every single American, Mortensen said. Mortensen's passion for safeguarding the elaborate fantasy world in which his conception of the Constitution resides is greatly respected by his like-minded friends and relatives, many of whom have been known to repeat his unfounded assertions verbatim when angered. Still, some friends and family members remain critical. That's great, but listening to all that talk radio has put some weird ideas into his head, said daughter Samantha, a freshman at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. He believes the Constitution allows the government to torture people and ban gay marriage, yet he doesn't even know that it guarantees universal health care. Mortensen told reporters that he'll fight until the bitter end for what he roughly supposes the Constitution to be. He acknowledged, however, that it might already be too late to win the battle. The freedoms our founding fathers spilled their blood for are vanishing before our eyes, Mortensen said. In under a year, a fascist socialist regime has turned a proud democracy into a totalitarian state that will soon control every facet of American life. Don't just take my word for it, Mortensen added. Try reading a newspaper. Or watching the news sometime. Anybody who thinks that that is just satire, that that is just fiction, that that's just a funny little thing, raise your hand. Just like Romper Room, through the magic of the internet, I can see all of you out there. I see Lottie, and I see Sue, and I see John, and I see Agnes. Yes, there's Agnes. And none of you have your hands up, oddly enough. Because it's real. Now, I'm not saying this story is real. I mean, it's The Onion, for God's sake. But this is a sort of archetypal social reality. Because, you know, we all know a Mr. Mortensen. I can't tell you the number of times when I'm out driving around this once lovely state, and Agnes has been with me on some of these little trips, when I'll say, honey, I'm going to follow this ass into the parking lot and straighten him up. No, Bob, keep driving. Bob, if you follow him into that Walmart parking lot, you and me are going to have a problem. Because one of these idiots, and I see them all, I mean, they're all over the place. They must have been handed out at the Second Baptist Church and Herpetological Park and Seminary at some point in time. Just a black bumper sticker with bold white letters. This is a Christian nation. And yeah, okay, granted, Agnes is sitting next to me to help deal with getting the interview lined up in a couple of minutes. But there's no getting around it. I have a confession to make. Sometimes when she hasn't been with me,
I've pulled up even with one of those Christian Nation cars and talking with both hands and driving with my knees turned to them, just, this is not a Christian nation! This is not a Christian nation! But we've got an entire segment of the population that thinks that that is happy to define the Constitution as something that happens within the fulminations of their poor and tormented brains. But now, as we move toward the conversation at the bottom of the hour, the counterpoint to the Onion piece. Headline, Senate bill would allow mentally incapacitated vets to buy guns. This is real news. This is reality. Major Nidal Hassan, accused of killing 13 people at Fort Hood Army Base, has been described by former colleagues as psychotic. As more details emerge about Hassan's troubled state, gun safety advocates are launching fresh attacks on a Senate bill they say would make it easier for mentally unstable veterans to buy firearms. Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina, says his Veterans Second Amendment Protection Act will protect veterans' gun rights. But the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence calls it a dangerous proposal that could allow over 100,000 mentally incapacitated or incompetent persons to buy guns, people who would previously have been barred from doing so by the Veterans Administration. By the way, if you're thinking this is just some weird right-wing measure, oh, you lose. This piece of stupidity is also co-sponsored by Democratic Senator from Virginia, Jim Webb. And when the Brady Center criticized this bit of ought-to-be satire idiocy, Burr decided to attack. He said that Brady Center President Paul Helmke was using the Fort Hood tragedy to exploit the senseless murder of American soldiers in the quest to secure personal triumph.
What, Edith, huh?
Bless his heart, Helmke responded. It is hardly exploitative to have an honest debate about the proposal, which would cancel out key provisions of the Gun Control Act of 1968 and override standards used by the VA for nearly four decades. God, this is like an argument between Spock and a Klingon in the fit of some unpronounceable war ritual.
You are a coward.
It is necessary that we protect society, sir.
I loathe you, and I spit on you, and I will eat your organs.
So do you see what I'm getting at? This is reality, and what I just read to you from The Onion is funny fiction. When it ought to be the other way around. Can you imagine anything more lunatic, any more insane than putting a bill out there? Hey, let's let the veterans who've had their brains scrambled in George Bush's War of Choice come home and buy more guns, so that when they wake up at us in a dead sweat at 3 o'clock in the morning and they're sure that they hear somebody outside the wire, and they can get their gun that they just bought at the Walmart and go out and blow away Mr. Simmons, who's walking his dog early before he has to go to work. Holy cow. It's astonishing to contemplate. And that's not, you know, that's just a smattering of what we have coming at us this evening. Another brilliant piece of satire coming our way maybe here in an hour or so. Also, the concert report from Horn intern Junior Grade Ferg. But right now, on the line with us is, in fact, as promised earlier, Singaporean activist and opposition leader, Chi-Soon Juan. And I want to get right to the conversation because I sincerely appreciate his taking time to join us for this conversation. Mr. Chi, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, thank you very much for joining us. I know it's taken some time to get things squared away and settled down and make this conversation happen, but I've really been looking forward to it, and I appreciate you being up so early in the morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Let's start just with a rundown. What did you think of President Obama's recent appearance there in your country?
Well, I think it was tremendously disappointing that he didn't address some of the very gross human rights violations and the repression here in Singapore. He was here basically to be talking trade and cooperation, economic cooperation amongst the Asia-Pacific countries. It is disappointing that he didn't see fit to at least raise human rights issues because, really, human rights and economic rights, they're one and the same. They're both sides of the same coin because one without the other just cannot make a democratic capitalist society function to the best of its ability.
Is it a case where we see some sort of a dichotomy in that, I personally, it seems to me that where we go in search of economic well-being, human rights are the first thing to go.
Yes, because business see it, human rights. That includes workers' rights, of course, and then your labor unions and trade unions. They see it as a hindrance to them generating maximum profit. And this is where, where they go and where governments are able to keep these rights at bay, keep workers from organizing, from having a voice in society, in the workplace. That's all the better for them. They can just do as they please. But they don't realize that something like that is not sustainable, and it's not speculation on my part. It's happened before in other economies where workers' rights, human rights are suppressed by dictators, and when the economy starts to unravel, as it inevitably will because there's no transparency and accountability, governments get corrupt, nothing is brought up to the surface, and everything just crumbles in the end. And so I was just hoping that at least President Obama could at least be able to make that connection there and say both sides of the argument just as important.
Well, to be quite honest, Singapore, for many people, I suspect, is not one of the countries that we think about most when we think of repressive regimes. That dishonor tends to go to places like Myanmar. But describe for the listeners, if you would please, sir, what you're talking about when you say repression in Singapore.
You're right in that sense. And when people think of Singapore, repression is not the first thing that comes to mind. But when I tell you that we have laws such as the Internal Security Act, which allows the government to detain citizens without trial and on an indefinite basis. We have had political prisoners, and I'm talking about elected members of parliament, that have been detained without trial for as long as the longest serving political prisoner in Singapore is 32 years. Let me put that into perspective. Nelson Mandela was in prison for only 27 years, and he was given a trial. This person, this Singaporean that was detained for, who was detained for 32 years, did not get a trial, was never charged for anything at all. If you visit our website today, you'll see this other political prisoner, the second longest serving prisoner, who was detained for 20 years without ever giving a trial. And these are things people don't know about. We have another law, it's called the Public Order Act, which was just passed a few months ago, and specifically because Mr. Obama was coming for this summit over this weekend. And this law states that not a single person, a lone individual, can protest, can even conduct a protest. That's the extent of the repression we have here. My colleagues and I face multiple charges for things such as distributing of pamphlets, and our charge states that it is an offense to demonstrate opposition to the actions of the government. And I'm quoting verbatim from the charge sheet itself. So that's the extent of the repression, and to give people your listeners an idea of the extent of the repression that we have here in Singapore that goes on here.
And of course, there's a vibrant business community in Singapore. So as you've discussed, the repression serves very well the business community, does it not?
Yes, especially for the multinational companies that work here. We have, like, even to the extent that the American representative in the Chambers of Commerce sits on a board here in Singapore that determines the wage level of Singaporeans. And you know, for me, that's not a capital society. Because my idea of a capital society is that labor is free to bargain with management for the wages. But over here in Singapore, there's a board or council that sits, and that council then determines the wage levels of workers here. That is the extent, again, of the economic repression, if you will.
That is stunning to me. That sounds, forgive me, it sounds either fascist or Soviet. I'm not sure which. So there's no collective bargaining. There is no means by which a worker can use the power of the workforce itself to secure better wages?
None whatsoever. I mean, you know, we have an umbrella trade union here, very much like what you think of as the AFL-CIO in the U.S. And this umbrella trade union is headed by a cabinet minister. It's almost like the labor secretary in the U.S. heading the AFL-CIO. But that's the extent of the situation that we have here. And we have workers here being paid, annually $5,000 U.S. dollars a year. And Singapore is a place that is as expensive as New York City and Chicago. And this is where I just cannot come to grips with this whole idea, but of political, not only political, but economic repression as well, and that's not tenable. That's not sustainable in the long run.
Obviously, you are the leader of a political party there. Your political party has been bankrupted. You have been financially punished. What is the Singapore Democratic Party? Has the government effectively neutered it?
Yeah, I mean, there are no opposition parties here. I mean, you know, we're talking about an opposition party that is just struggling to survive. I personally have been dragged to court on three separate occasions, and this is not the criminal prosecutions, apart from those that I just mentioned earlier on. I've been sued for defamation. When we speak up and against government policies, they sue us for defamation, and I've been sued on three separate occasions already, and I've been ordered to pay a total of more than $1 million U.S. dollars. I tried to pay off some of these loans, but these damages, which my wife and I, we sold off our house, our car, and all our possessions, and we couldn't make good the rest of the payments. I was made a bankrupt, and as a bankrupt, I cannot speak in public during elections. I am banned from standing for elections, and I'm barred from leaving Singapore. My party, now the Singapore Democratic Party, has also been sued for defamation, and the party has also been ordered to pay hundreds of thousands in damages. And so that's where we stand right now, and we are staring into the barrel and of being made a bankrupt and wound up.
Well, for a sense of perspective, sir, what constitutes such defamation in the eyes of the ruling party in Singapore?
Well, you know, one of the lawsuits that I went through was because I said that the government was not transparent with our public funds, with state funds, when it had loaned billions of dollars to the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia. This was in the 1990s. And I stood up during an election rally and pointed this out. And because of that, I was sued. But what's even worse was when I had tried to defend myself in the court, the court didn't allow me to have a trial because it just awarded the case to the plaintiff, who was prime minister, and I'm sorry, not the prime minister, but government leader in Singapore. And one of whom was the prime minister. And I was just made to pay these damages even without trial.
Is this sort of governmental repression, is it accompanied by what I would consider brutal police tactics as well?
Yes, I mean you have this whole a nexus of laws that will not allow us even to have peaceful small groups of protest in on the street. And every time when we come together, even just for a simple activity like distributing flyers, for example, we are charged for illegal assembly. And this is there was one situation whereby we were wanted to conduct a protest when the World Bank and IMF had a meeting here in Singapore. And that was in 2006. Well, the police they just stopped us, and the whole horde of them just prevented us from moving, and we were held on the sidewalk for nonstop for 3 days, and we were not allowed to move or go to proceed with our activity, and that's the extent of the state action that the police would take.
You have mentioned that Singapore is a very expensive place to live, and you have mentioned that many Singaporeans live on less than $5,000 U.S. per year. What percentage of the Singaporean population, if you know, sir, is in desperate straits?
Oh, there is a significant layer of underclass that people don't see, of the homeless, the destitute. The only difference here in Singapore is that the government is very efficient at cleaning up the streets. In other words, there is a unit, for example, that goes around on a bi-monthly basis and goes around and gets to some of these destitute homeless people round them up and put them in halfway houses. And it's just that kind of situation where it's out of sight, out of mind. But it doesn't mean that these people don't exist. It's just that the government is very much more efficient in making sure that the public doesn't see, or at least the international community doesn't see, some of these underclass people that exist in Singapore.
Just as background, how did you come into this struggle? How did you come to this controversy? What was your upbringing, your training, your teaching, your life?
You know, I did my undergraduate and my graduate studies in the U.S. And in psychology, it didn't have very much to do with politics, really. But when I came home and I saw what was going on, that the people did not have a voice, and people who were voiceless were downtrodden and just didn't have a say in their society. And I just thought it was not something that I wanted to live with and to put up and just keep my head bowed and not say anything about. And so I joined the opposition. And at that time, when I returned from the U.S., I was teaching at the university over here. And within months of joining the opposition, I was dismissed and subsequently sued and for defamation. But that was something that really made it I don't regret it. I don't. Absolutely not. Because it was something that I feel that ought to have been done, and I'm glad that I did it. But it's something that I don't want to have to continue to put up with, and that's why it's important for us to speak up and actively work towards the system's demise.
Singapore's leader, Lee Kuan Yew, has been in office how long? How consolidated is his power base?
Well, since 1959, he was the president. Oh, I'm sorry, he was the prime minister for about 3 decades. And after he left office, he's still in the cabinet as a minister mentor, and there's no doubt that he's the paramount leader. Currently, his son is prime minister. His daughter-in-law, the prime minister's wife, has been put in charge of state funds. I think we call it the sovereign wealth fund that goes around and invests in, globally in all kinds of institutions and all, you know, in all business ventures. And the whole thing is that the decisions are kept within these three persons, and no one, no Singaporean knows, the government won't reveal where these funds are being invested, how they're being used, and it's this kind of non-transparency and accountability that is, you know, it's absurd. I mean, we lost hundreds of billions of dollars when we invested in Citibank, Citigroup, and Merrill Lynch that went, you know, belly up. And, you know, no one is held accountable. And we still don't know how these funds are being used all over the world.
So for all intents and purposes, with some sort of a governmental veneer, we're talking about a country that is basically ruled by a hereditary oligarchy at this point?
Well, yeah, it's very much, you know, within the family still, because, as I said, Lee Kuan Yew, the father, is still, he's titled it Minister Mentor. That's his official title. And his son is the Prime Minister. And, you know, it's something that, I think, you know, democratic society would want to see, especially if there are, free and fair elections, which there aren't in Singapore. Our elections here could not be any more unfree and unfair. Everything is controlled by the Prime Minister's office. And, you know, we have people that are still absolutely terrified of voting for the opposition.
And with given the tactics that you have described in the way of harassment of the opposition, one is hard-pressed to even put opposition candidates on the ballot, I would assume. Is that correct?
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. I mean, in past elections, we have so too much difficulty just trying to get candidates, people to join the party and offer them as candidates. But every election, come election, the opposition cannot field more than half of the seats that are up for grabs in parliament. And so, you know, even before the first vote is cast, the ruling party is returned to power. And then they make threats to citizens saying that, well, if you don't vote for us, your precinct, your housing estate will not get public funds to get your public facilities upgraded. You won't get your libraries. You won't get your school. You won't get your public transport. And that's the extent of the kind of threats that they will go to intimidate the voters.
So, Singapore has this reputation of being a very peaceful, orderly place. If I understand correctly, you are suggesting that that is something that is achieved via strict suppression of any of the fundamental urges toward basic human being.
When you look at Nazi Germany, I mean, the trains ran on time. The places were clean. Crime rate was low. This is how has it got to do with the fact that, this is really wrong thinking that somehow you need a dictatorship, to be able to keep the streets clean and orderly. I've seen very many places that I've been to. That are just as orderly and just as tidy. I mean, look at some of the cities in Canada and the U.S. and in Australia. But at the same time, people are free to, you know, to express their views. This is where I feel that there is this misconception that somehow you need an authoritarian regime to be able to keep the place neat and tidy and so on. If I remember, President Kennedy had said that, you know, you have the security of a graveyard. Is that really what people really want?
How did it come to this? What was the genesis of this restrictive authoritarian regime? Is it something that arises out of the Second World War, or is it of newer vintage than that?
Well, before World War II, we were a British colony. That is, for ages, we were a British colonial outpost. And when we gained independence, Lee Kuan Yew came into power, and he was the poster boy. I mean, at that time, the British loved him because he espoused all the values that, you know, a liberal government would do. But the minute he came to power, he closed the door and he put grease down the pole, if you will, and made it impossible for the opposition to exist and crack down and to detain all his opponents without trial. And from there on, democracy didn't stand a chance, and that the system has gone on for more than half a century already, and we're still, we haven't seen any signs of the system letting up.
If I may be so personal, Mr. Chi, given what the government has done to you, how do you and your wife survive?
You know, I've not been able to find a job since I was back from the university. I mean, I was basically trained and as an academic, doing research and teaching, and I did a lot of work on neuroscience. And since I was back, I've not been able to get back into the field again. I've had to write to get my to publish my book and then sell them on the streets because very few bookstores here would sell them in their stores. So you know, we've had to eat out a living and get by with, I'm not looking at. It's something that I just had to do, and you get on with it. But the more important thing right now is for me to continue to be able to speak up to the people that don't have a voice.
Oh, here, sir. I asked the question mainly because it seems so brutally efficient to do what they have done to you, insofar as they have said you're bankrupt, so you can't run for office. We've thrown you out of your teaching and research position, and as an added bonus, we're not going to let you leave the country. So it's not just enough that they attempt to silence you; they want to make sure that you they silence you in every way conceivable. Because theoretically, you could at least leave the country and go and work from outside. But even that avenue has been foreclosed to you.
Yeah, they are putting a tremendous amount of pressure on my family and I. But, you know, you don't fail when you don't succeed. You fail when you give up, and that's not something I intend to do, because it would just give them a lot of satisfaction if they see me wanting to up and leave and say it's not that I can, but it's something which I'm determined to hang on to. But you're right, it's very, it's very efficient, it's comprehensive, this kind of repression.
Well, if you could have your way and simply ask of the American people, the freedom loving community, for remedies for Singapore, what would it be?
You know, for the American people, just to be pragmatic and to be hard nosed about what their interests are. It may be surprising for me to say something like this, but just take a look at your multinational corporations that go out into the world and do conduct business. They don't want, where they can function most effectively if there is no labor union to contend with, no workers' rights to have to worry about. They can maximize their profit and repatriate all their profit. But that's sustainable. Such, you know, if you cannot, you know, kind of bully American people, you go out and bully the Asian people, the African people, and people that you can that you can collaborate with governments to suppress. So if the American people can see it and just think of it in the long term interest, that, you know, democracy makes good economic sense, that you don't suppress workers in order to maximize profit. If the American people can see that and then continue to work towards a situation whereby their multinational corporations go out into the world to do business, don't resort to such practices. I think that the term there is corporate social responsibility. and make sure that the ethics are adhered to as well. And that would help tremendously the American interest as well.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation your website. Would you share that with us, please?
Yes, you know, it's yoursdp.org, Y-O-U-R, S in Singapore, Democratic, D, and Party. In one word, yoursdp at, sorry, yoursdp.org. And we try to put up as much information as possible to be able to reach out to Singapore as well as the international community and to kind of educate people what kind of society that Singapore is. And if you look at our website today, even today, you will find a video that shows a political prisoner that I mentioned earlier on who was incarcerated for 20 years. He's in his 80s right now. And if you hear the ordeal that he had to go through, it's heartbreaking. And I don't want, that should never happen to anyone in the world just because he wanted to have some decency to be able to speak up for his fellow citizens that could have some semblance of democracy in the country. So I would urge you, if you're listening, please visit and take a look at this video and see the real Singapore for themselves instead of this whole facade that the tourist promotion board has put on that Singapore is a clean and green society that is a unique place to, and fun place to visit.
And would something like listeners writing to their elected representatives in this country to try to educate them on the state of affairs in Singapore, would that be beneficial?
Yes, of course. As members of Congress, just alert them to the very fact that if you want to continue doing business in Singapore, don't ignore these human rights, because there are people suffering, there are people having a hard time in Singapore, and it's just ignoring human rights is akin to exploitation. That is not what I believe the U.S. wants as well. I'm right to the State Department. I get the State Department to pay attention more to the human rights violations here and the extent of the repression here, and that would certainly help not just the people, but you know, people who don't have a voice here in Singapore.
Do you have any reason to think or hope or believe that any sort of private communication was had between the ruling elite in Singapore and the Obama administration when he visited?
No, I think all signs pointed indicated that the administration, U.S. officials, were just not interested at this stage in wanting to have anything to do with human rights. I think Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was here for quite a few days. And I, to my knowledge, I don't think there was any opportunity that she had had to meet up with not just the opposition, but the civil society. So, you know, I don't think there's any interest at this stage, which is a shame, and it's very short-sighted.
Well, I find it at the very least a little bit ironic that President Obama spoke in the People's Republic of China today and spoke about urging the Chinese government to relax its so-called Great Firewall of China to allow greater internet access for its people, and yet would have remained so sadly quiet in Singapore. Frankly, the Chinese exercise a great deal more control over our own economy than Singapore does. Is this strictly a matter of corporatism, then?
I think it is. I think Singapore is the place for a lot of corporations, global corporations that are headquartered here. I'm not sure whether that was the reason or not, but certainly I don't think there was any discussion on human rights, or at least there was, but it wasn't made public. But what's the point of really talking about human rights when it's not made public? And this is where, you know, I don't understand. But, you know, again, we're not saying that human rights issues should be the front and center of all the discussions here in Singapore. But what we're saying is that don't ignore it. Don't just completely not discuss it, because it's important as talking about anything else in society.
And I'm sure, well, and, you know, there's the additional question of even had even had the White House press corps covering the president's visit wanted to, the Singaporean government would have made it very much difficult for them to speak to a dissident such as yourself, would they not?
Oh, yes. I mean, there is a law, it's not a law that prohibits the international media from, quote-unquote, interfering in domestic affairs. In other words, I'm interviewing people like me. And because I had given a couple of interviews to BBC and CNN and CNBC, for example, and within months, as I said, the government came out with a law to outlaw some of these media organizations, international organizations, from talking about political situation in Singapore. And you have a lot of news organizations that have been sued for defamation as well. I mean, Time, Newsweek, International Herald Tribune, you name it, Bloomberg, for example, they've all been taken to court and sued for defamation and have been made to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages to Lee Kuan Yew and some of the other government officials.
I know this may sound superfluous, but frankly, I have no fear of them. But I did.
They will not touch you in the U.S. because, they, in order to sue you, they have to go through the U.S. court. And that is not going to be something that they're willing to do because, if you defend yourself, they'll be made laughing stock, and it's not something that they would even contemplate.
I know it may seem strange to say it, but it would, for those very reasons that you mentioned, it would provide a delightful opportunity to bring light to this issue because, well, frankly, I remember the story going back, into the 90s with the caning incident with the young American man, and our right wing was saying, oh, yeah, beat him some more. That's what we need. We need to have laws like Singapore has. And all that while I was thinking, this is not where we want to go. And I think the Singaporean government got a lot of bad press out of that. And what we need to do is get them some more bad press. And I really thank you very much, Mr. Chi, for joining us this evening. And I wish you all the best. I'm already getting emails from listeners wanting to know more. So we will send them to yoursdp.org, and hopefully they will learn from it and act on it. And I wish you the very best, sir. I wish you the very best.
I thank you, and thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
It was an absolute, it was a pleasure for me as well. Take care, sir.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Chi Soon Won of the SDP in Singapore. He is a persecuted political opponent of the dictatorship there. And I don't hesitate to use the word dictatorship because it is what it is. And simply putting a veneer... I'll be honest. I'm tired of this American real politic that says we don't care what they do as long as they agree with us. It has gotten us into a morass of almost incomprehensible breadth and scope. That cynical approach to international relations. From how we deal with Cuba, to how we deal with the People's Republic of China, to how we deal with the Saudi Arabians, to how we deal with repressive regimes like Uzbekistan. Is it the Uzbek leader who boils his political opponents alive? No, I think so. And there has to be a break with that past if, in fact, the realities of change we can believe in is to actually sink roots and send up something that can grow and thrive. I'm very grateful to Chi Soon Won for that conversation. He lives at hazard. And it astonishes me to imagine what... No, it doesn't astonish me. It impresses me to know what people are willing to do in order to secure, what did Madison and that crowd call it? The blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity? Those are words to live by. Those are words to live by, not some corporate charter that says we hereby vow to maximize profits at the expense of human life and human dignity. So thank you to Chi-Soon Won. I do appreciate it. We will come back. I have Horn intern junior grade Ferg in the studio. We will talk about last night's show and many other things as well. You are listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to the Horn.
We kill for oil, then we throw a party when we win. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Right at 15 minutes past the hour as we begin the second hour of tonight's program, this Monday evening program. And that was serious, heady business that we were talking with Chi-Soon Juan about. And I wanted to put a little bit of, if you can, and I'm sure you do know what I mean, I wanted to put a little bit of psychic space, if you will, between that and what we're going to do next. Because, as promised, we now have a concert report. Ferg's first concert review by horn intern junior grade Ferg. As you know, we let me do this and make everything work the way it needs to work right now. Stand by. Right, because this one's open, Simon.
I know that.
Okay, so don't touch the mic. Just
got it.
You know, there's some things that you got to reinforce. Son, don't touch the mic. you don't know. You'd have to see the chaos that is this studio to understand what I have to do to get me a microphone and him a microphone, because once upon a time, Agnes produced from the chair that I'm in, and I used to sit over in the corner with my very unhappy little microphone. Sparky in the chat room says, he sounds pumped. Oh, he is, Sparky. He is. So, backstory, you know, I talked about it all evening on Friday, and we were stoked, and we stayed stoked, and it was like 48 hours of the night before Christmas for Ferg.
It was like Christmas time.
Yeah, right.
Something a new present.
Yeah, only it was 48 hours worth.
Yes.
So, we through the kind offices of David in Tennessee.
Thank you, David.
Yes.
I love you.
He does. He does. David made contact with Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers and got us put on the guest list and a pair of backstage passes. And so we went to the show last night and had excellent seats.
And, okay, I don't know. What is this going to be, stream of consciousness freeform? Let's see. What'd they open with, Ferg? Ghost to Most, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. It was awesome. It felt like the bass drum was in my soul. It blew me in... that sounded a little perverted, but it blew me away.
Yeah, it was rattling your innards.
It made me feel like it was touching my soul. I was like, ah.
Yeah, and you'll remember that Ferg is a... he is a learning drummer, a learning guitar player.
A learning piano player.
A learning keyboardist. And...
learning mandolin.
A learning mandolinist, otherwise known as the 8-string misery box.
And I want a banjo.
Yeah, he wants a banjo. He ain't getting a banjo. I told him, no, we're going to master what we got so far.
Need to learn the banjo duel on Deliverance.
No, stop it. But anyway, they opened with Ghost to Most, followed with, I was sitting there all night long trying to memorize the set list. What was the second song?
I don't know, but it was like, I swear.
The Righteous Path. The Righteous Path. And then they went to the opening act.
Which was they dedicated it to UFO.
Yeah.
Because what they were talking about in 77.
Not they, Patterson was.
Well, Patterson. Where he was in 77 on Thanksgiving weekend over at the Civic Center listening to AC/DC. Who was UFO and who else, Dad?
Well, UFO was the opening act for AC/DC at the Charleston Civic Center in Charleston, yeah.
And who else was it, the Motorhead?
The main part was, it was AC/DC and UFO.
Yeah, but he said how UFO was just as, maybe not as good anywhere else, but that night they were just as good as any other band.
Because the time that Patterson was talking about, the time frame he was talking about, he was roughly the same age as Ferg.
Yeah.
Yeah, and see, there it is in the chat room, Big Baldy in the chat room. UFO, I remember those guys. And the degree of, could you tell, Ferg, what a degree of warmth that Patterson felt for the audience?
Well, I mean, he was, I can't really explain. I've heard other people talk. He was very real with the audience, and he felt like he could connect with them, and I mean he just had that realistic point of view. He wasn't bull hawking us. He wasn't cutting around the chase or anything. I mean, he just went straight forward to it, and he talked about his life and how he was and how he grew up and how music helped him understand everything, and how music made him have a better life. So, I mean, I think he connected with the audience pretty well through that. Because, I mean, so many people. I mean, I just want to be like him someday. Because so many people look up to him and wish they were him. Or were married to him.
what I think you're recognizing, Ferg, is that the lack of artifice. It was, I don't think Ferg's ever seen This Is Spinal Tap, but it wasn't that moment when the guy walks out on stage in Detroit and says, "Hello, Cleveland." No, not at all.
And it came out with Jack Daniels and beer.
Yes, there was Jack Daniels and beer on the stage. Trust the 13-year-old to notice that.
I thought it was so awesome that they were drinking while they were playing. That's like the best.
Yeah, but you got to get real good before you can ever do that.
I know, but I don't know how they didn't get messed up. I mean, it looked like they were sweating it all out, but it looked like they were having such a grand old time up there.
They were, and that's the other thing. Nobody wants to watch a band go through the motions.
I love it.
And that was not what was going on. These guys were really into it, in part because of the fact that the last time they were here, they made an appearance on a show that goes out over, what do they call it now, American Public Media? Called Mountain Stage, and it's produced every week, and then it's subsequently put out for broadcast by affiliate public radio stations. And the last time they were here, Patterson was dealing with walking pneumonia and pleurisy, and he got out on the stage, sang one song against his own better judgment,
and then sort of crawled off stage, and as he said last night, was afraid he was going to die.
He did. I thought it was funny how he was explaining it, especially with all the words.
Especially with all the words? What does that mean?
The words.
Oh, the fun words?
The fun words. You know, the F-U-C-K.
Hey.
Some people don't know how to spell. I mean, it's okay.
Stop it. But, well, it's a reality stage experience.
It was amazing. I mean, there's no coming back from that. It was something you can't get over. I mean, I can still feel the bass drum. It still feels like I'm sitting in that seat.
Did you talk about it at school today?
Yes, and the teachers knew who they were. I go up to girls and say, hey, I went backstage on a concert. And they went, really? What missed there? And I went, okay. Pulled out my backstage pass, and I was like, there you go. Proof. And then one of my best friends had said, oh, you didn't go backstage. You're lying. And I pulled it out, and I did show and tell. And I explained everything I did. And I explained about the groupies.
He saw his first groupies last night.
And I learned a new street word.
We will leave it at that.
I know. I'm not going to say anything else about the groupies. It was so cool, though. I wish I had groupies. I need a groupie.
And at backstage in the conversation, the brief conversation we had with Patterson, he brought that up, and Patterson's response was, well, that's why all any of us learned to play guitar for.
It was amazing. I mean, I watched him, and all you hear is,
Good crowd noise, son.
I know. It's a delay effect.
So what did you get out of watching the musicians? I mean, were you just too stunned with the whole totality of the circumstance to pick up any tips, any pointers?
Well, actually, I did pick up some tips and pointers. When you drink and play, you look like you have more fun.
Okay, see, you're being shallow there. That's not the lesson you were supposed to learn.
Okay, actually, I did learn a lesson. Some of their songs really actually spoke to me. I'm not talking about just listening to the music. If you listen to the words to a couple songs, they really actually tell you some stuff. And it's a story when they sing. It's a story. Their songs aren't just somewhere like Nickelback making up some song about love or something. Their songs are a story.
Are you talking about Patterson's introduction of Let There Be Rock Show?
Yes. It was amazing. I liked it. I about cried.
What? Why?
It was just the guitar playing. I mean, the bass playing. It was just as David said. The bass and the drums work together like two snakes making love to each other. It was just that amazing. It's something you can't get over. Y'all haven't lived until you've heard the Drive-By Truckers play live. And, I mean, just the... And they didn't go in all of the pyrotechnics or anything. Now, I think that's also what...
What? No lasers?
No.
No smoke machines?
No. I don't think their concerts do not need that. Their songs are enough pyrotechnics. Just enough. I mean, just the way, like... For instance, one of the guitar solos... I love how they use the slide because, I mean, it just has that, it gives you an adrenaline rush, but at the same time, it's making you calm.
See, I was surprised. The one thing I haven't heard yet, I'm still getting I Want a Banjo. given the absolute the artistic perfection of the way it's played, I'm surprised I haven't gotten Dad, I Want a Pedal Steel yet.
I don't want a pedal steel. I want a banjo.
Oh, God, what am I going to do? I'd feel better about the pedal steel.
I need a banjo, because not just anybody can play a banjo. But, I mean, back to the concert. The way the concert was set up, I mean, is half the fun is getting there. I mean, you get twice the fun listening to the music, but half the fun is sitting there, and it gives you that... I don't know how to explain it. It's not adrenaline, and it's not excitement. It's more of a, oh my gosh, you gotta get out there and play. If you don't, I'm gonna die. It's just that, I guess you could call it anticipation.
I think what Ferg is describing is the 30 minutes or so before the show started, when every 2 minutes was, do you think they're gonna play soon, Dad? Are they gonna start soon, Dad? Dad, when are they gonna start? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and you can't control your bladder during a concert.
Oh, stop it.
No, I mean, I did, but it's, like, super hard because you get so excited, and then everything's, like...
You are not a chihuahua.
Everything's rushing around you, and you're like, You just get that little... And some of their songs, you just get a little chill up your spine.
Well, when Patterson was talking before they went into Let There Be Rock show, and he was talking about how rock and roll showed him that there was a world outside, and he used lots of fun words.
Tons.
A world outside the petty little high school world he was living in. Did that have any meaning for you, Ferg?
Yes, it did. Matter of fact, as much of a coincidence as I thought it was today, I went back to school and they were talking about how. Sorry, my dad's talking to me real quick.
No, I'm telling you to get up on the mic.
I don't want to get up on the mic. I like relaxing. I'm a relaxed guy.
He wants to direct.
But anyways, I thought it was a coincidence how I went back to school today and there was a quote. It was talking about rock and roll, but it was using it as more of a kid standpoint, how, like, they have to mix some stuff in quotes. You use two quotes for one. They were talking about how video games are becoming more healthy for you. People say that video games are bad for you. They said just the same about rock and roll. Rock and roll, it's a little bit more different. I took it into more of a moderation standpoint. I mean, rock and roll can teach you so many different things. And you can tell the mood by a certain rock and roll song. I mean, for instance, think of a song. I'm not going to name any songs. I'm just trying to get one in my head. Like, okay, piano songs, you can tell a different mood. Somebody's mad. Somebody's real serious, sad.
Yeah.
I mean, they can teach you that through a song. And I guess that can also teach you there's more to life than just this. There are so many open doors for me. I just have to walk through it. And I will be there.
What does it take, though, Ferg? What does it take?
Oh, man. Hard work, effort. You have to have your priorities and goals set in a straight line, and you got to be willing to reach for the stars. You have to love it when you do it. You can't just do something you don't love. And
you can't wait for magic to make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you can go to sleep and dream about it all you want and wish upon a bunch of stars. If you don't do the hard work and you don't make the effort, that dream's never going to come true. It's just the same as now. I'm hoping, I want to master the guitar and I want to master the drums. I want to form my own band, but I have to work for it and I have to make the effort, and so do the other people that are willing to make the effort with me. And I mean, it'll be a long road and a long journey, but I think it'd be willing. I'd be willing to do it. I think it'd be a good opportunity. I'm excited to see what happens for me in the future. I mean, Patterson, he went from somebody that he even told me he went from somebody that wasn't so cool to now he's a major rock star. And people back in high school that used to make fun of him and stuff are like, oh, we were good buddies back then and stuff like that. I envy him.
Well, you've got an email in from David in Tennessee. He said when we were talking about the no need for pyrotechnics, the songs have that. David says, Ferg, you're trying to describe fulfillment.
Fulfillment, yes.
Good live music fulfills. Bladder control urgency? That's what every performer feels and reacts to just before going on stage. That's just Ferg coming closer to his performer era. Some precursor to hitting the boards. And P.S., reach for the stars and wear your ass out in the meantime.
I'll try, David. And remember, I love you for this. I mean,
you've already got an I love you back, Ferg.
Okay. I mean, I can't thank you enough for this. I mean, you gave me an opportunity, and I took it, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And every minute that lasted, I wish I was still there. I wish I could repeat this night. Because, I mean, as much as you think, oh, I'm so tired and I want to go home, I was up, man, Dad, like, what, 4 or 5 hours past my curfew?
Past your bedtime.
Curfew. I like to say curfew because I'm a teenager.
No, because it's not like you're out, you know, drinking Milwaukee's best down an old dirt road somewhere.
I don't.
It's just a bedtime.
Milwaukee's. No.
Shut up.
But anyways, I mean, if I can become what Patterson is today, then I will have fulfilled my lifelong dream of becoming a rock star. I mean, sure. I mean, I want to pass people up. I want to go in the fast lane.
Oh dear. Okay, I'm getting the idea that now that we've got the cool front end, it's time to it's time to start talking about people like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, you know.
You see, I mean, I can.
Listen, young Skywalker, there's a dark side too.
I know there's a dark side.
The Force is strong with this one. Ferg, thanks. Go on out of here. Get your homework done.
I'm already done. I had algebra.
Well, then do more.
I don't want to do any more algebra.
No, you got to do more algebra.
It's awful.
Yes, I know it is, and it makes no sense. But the thing is, while it makes no sense to you now, there is every chance in the world that you'll wind up a balding 46-year-old.
What does PXQCS?
No, stop. There's every chance in the world you'll wind up a balding 46-year-old who thinks, you know, this algebra is pretty cool now that I've got the brain to comprehend it. So away with you, Ferg.
Good night. There's your microphone back. I love you.
Yeah, thanks. What did I say? Don't touch the microphone.
Good night, David. I love you. Love you forever.
And he really, really does. Go on. Shoo. Get. Away with you. There's something out there that you don't know that needs learning. Goodbye. Go do scales. Do something. And there goes Horn Intern Junior Grade Ferg after his first rock and roll show. And, you know, I can't be too rough on him for not memorizing the set list. I didn't either. How can I put this? I was guilty of living vicariously through my son last night. Because I remember my first rock show, and I don't think it was nearly as cool as this one was. Because, among other things, I think my first rock and roll show was Pablo Cruz, okay? So just, you know, what you going to do when she says goodbye compared to The Righteous Path? Now, I think Ferg wins this round. But I was also watching him and watching him take it all in. And it was just such... Well, it was magic. His eyes were as big as goose eggs. Just catching everything from one thing to another. I don't know. It was like a spider monkey on Mountain Dew. That's all I can say. But the show report was promised, and it was delivered. Just as a small token of thanks, we took Patterson a copy of the new book that is out. It's a coffee table book, and it's a beautiful thing. It's called Plundering Appalachia. And just as a little bit of backstory on the concert, it was held at the Clay Center, which is the big arts center in Charleston. Beautiful building. A matter of exquisite vision. Um, The concert series are individually sponsored. And last night's sponsor, we were told at the beginning of the program, everybody give a big round of applause to Roger Nicholson. Roger's a vice president of the International Coal Group. And it was one of those moments where I had to catch my lower lip between my teeth and bite till it hurts to keep from hollering out, thanks, Roger, for Sago! Thanks. But, yeah, that ICG, International Coal Group. But then in the course of the description that Ferg was talking about, where Patterson was talking about his concert experience at the Charleston Civic Center in November of 1977, and AC/DC with the warm-up act UFO, and he went on to say, you know, we were up here because for a couple of years my granddad had left home to take a job building some sort of industrial nightmare around here. He said, I think it was a refinery or something like that. And he said, and I'm sure that it's still polluting your world and just putting a lot of shit into your environment. And at that moment, it just something in my heart went, yes, yes, yes. Because as you can tell by listening to the music, I think in particular off of the album The Dirty South, Putting People on the Moon. Let me know a long time ago that those guys are aware of what's going on. So Patterson seemed fairly pleased to receive that copy of Plundering Appalachia, and there are stunning stories and photography in there. A little something to look at on the bus on the way home. It was a magnificent night. If you are ever within reach of going to see a trucker's show, treat yourself. Do yourself a favor. Go see it. Because it's a rock and roll experience that is unlike anything going on out there today. Because it is A, real, B, honest, C, unpretentious, and D, genius. And if you get a chance to see it in an environment somewhat less restrictive than the Clay Center, you'll be even luckier. You know, because the Clay Center auditorium's got like two levels of balconies and side boxes where people, where women can sit in furs with little opera glasses and stuff like that. It ain't made for rock and roll. So, anyway, we had a marvelous time. And it was just, it's something that will not soon be forgotten. It's about 20 minutes before the hour. And I know we've been talking for quite some time, but let's see if there's anybody left, left on the lines. So we've got empty lines across the board. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. The local dialing number is 304-658-3333. That'll save us a nickel or a buck instead of going toll-free, if you wish. And, you know, share what's on your mind. Remember, you know, this is not one of those radio shows where you have to be thinking about, you know, wrapped up in whatever issue has grabbed my attention for the time being. You can drive this bus as well as I can. Just a nice little, you know, we had the story that, you know, that should be fake news that actually turns out to be real, that there are actual senators out there who want to put firearms in the hands of people who have profound mental illnesses. Well, a lot of those people and a lot of the shooting and killing that happens in this country is done by people who call themselves followers of the Prince of Peace. So Dallas Dem over at Daily Coast penned this the other day, and it was sent along to me. I think Dennis sent this along. Yeah, it was Dennis. And I just wanted to share it with you for a minute before we do go back to the phones. The title, The Unspoken Christian Problem in the United States. Why does the mainstream media continue to ignore the Christian problem here in the United States? According to the FBI, an estimated 1,382,012 violent crimes occurred nationwide in 2008. And 99% of those crimes were committed by Christians. In fact, Christians in the United States murdered over 14,000 Americans last year. Christians also committed close to 10 million property crimes against Americans last year. One of Christianity's major subsects, Catholics, are responsible for the majority of illegal immigration from Mexico into this country. Christian bankers on Wall Street have wrecked the economy. Last spring, a Christian terrorist drove around Dallas randomly shooting people on the freeways. Why is political correctness preventing the media from saying what we all know is true? That Christians in America pose a grave danger and that you and your family are likely to be victims of Christian criminals sometime in your life. While many claim that Christianity is a religion of peace, hundreds of wars in the past 2,000 years have been started by Christians, and while gunpowder may have been discovered by the Chinese, just about every weapon of modern civilization has been developed by Christian scientists and engineers. There can be no doubt that Christians are responsible for just about everything that's wrong in America. I say, send them all back where they came from. Note, again, it's satire. On the other hand, this isn't. Now, as backstory, you remember that at their little tea party thing that they had to dummy up the footage about on Fox News and show Glenn Beck's larger but still not the hell not very large 9/12 rally? Fox had to insert 9/12 footage into their coverage of the teabagger rally because there just weren't enough teabaggers to go around to make it look like it was a big million teabagger march, right? And you'll recall that one of the signs there was a great big photographic description, a photographic depiction of stacked bodies at Dachau from the Holocaust, and comparing that to what would happen to Merca if we was to get that socialized medicine. Some people, including many decent people such as myself, thought that that was rather sickening. And it was also criticized by people who actually know what the Holocaust was, which the teabaggers don't. Remember, they live in a world that they live in an America of their own imagination. Wow, there's a potential satire song. Not America the Beautiful, America the Imaginary. And one of the people who evinced something less than pleasure with seeing the Holocaust and the millions dead in it used for political gain by right-wing teabaggers who have more in common with the perpetrators of the Holocaust than with the victims thereof, was Elie Wiesel, author of Night. I'm sure a lot of you have read Night. It is not an easy read, but it's something that probably everyone should read. Well, over at America Blog, John Aravosis posted a photograph of Elie Wiesel at Buchenwald. More than half starved. More than half naked. Bones showing through skin. It is tragic, of course. John Aravosis writes, Holocaust survivor and Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel criticized a teabagger protest in Washington, D.C., a protester who had held up a sign showing dead bodies from the Dachau concentration camp stacked in a pile and compared this to the Democrats' health care reform plan. Over at Politico, the teabaggers weighed in to share their thoughts on Wiesel's criticism. As follows.
Rothschild's nothing. Everyone knows that Obama is George Soros' sock puppet. Wasn't Soros Jewish once upon a time? May the Schwartz be with ye.
Then there's this little nugget of tolerant beauty.
The Jews need to clam up and accept the fact that they're in a Christian country.
Then this.
This Holocaust thing,
that's Hollowcost,
this Holocaust thing is totally overblown by the Jewish.
And then this, and I think this must be a relative of the Moran guy.
Elie Wiesel should just go back to Indonesia. I don't see him condemning the terrorist shooter at Fort Hood.
But the beauty of morons, hateful though they may be, is that when they come out, you know, they don't just come out in force, and they don't just come out timid. They come out in the full flowering monstrosity of their manifest stupidity. Witness the following:
Ellie is a whiner. She should stop her whining. You did not complain when the libs were calling Bush Hitler.
She should stop her whining. You can't fix stupid.
You know what? The fact is that at a time in history, the Rothschild family controlled practically everything. This is a fact, not anti-Semitic. I respect the Jewish outrage at everything. I'm a Tea Partier. Obama is a Marxist and takes his orders from George Soros. It is similar, and these people need to get a life.
Imagine that, telling a Holocaust survivor to get a life.
Woo! Why any Jew would support the Obama administration is a mystery anyway. He is a Muslim sympathizer and the greatest threat to Israel ever to sit in the White House. Wake up, Jewish community. Take off the blinders. Ellie, how did that whole Madoff thing work out for you?
Elie Wiesel, newest, most current tool of the sick, perverted, racist, anti-Semitic Democrat Party.
Have you no shame, Democrats?
Most American Jews are not very religious, and many are outright unbelievers, Jews in name only. Many older Jews in America feel shame for being in America rather than immigrating to Israel in the late 1940s. Many sent money to help the colonization, and a few sent army surplus rifles, but the majority came up with the most interesting excuses for not answering the call to gather together and forge their homeland.
Elie Wiesel is a disgusting PR-seeking, profiteering demagogue who's made a fortune off playing on the world's guilt trips about what happened to the Jews during World War II. Most objective WW2 researchers agree now that the bestial Nazis who happen to be anti-capitalist socialists...
Oh, God. Socialists.
Yeah. Killed even more Slavs and Gypsies in their concentration camps than Jews. But you don't see the Slavs and Gypsies trying to profit off the Holocaust like some of the shameless, powerful Jews in the media...
You know, we don't need them to republish the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. It is sunk way in. Did you hear? Prophet, shameless and powerful Jews in the media. God, that sounds like, that reminds me of Richard Nixon with that taped conversation with Billy Graham. Billy, we could really change things in America, but it's those Jews in Hollywood who keep, it's those damned Hollywood Jews. The Jews in the media. I sometimes wonder what has happened to the Jewish people. The Bible says that they are God's people and Israel is their homeland. I see so many Jews seem to have abandoned their faith, and I think this has to sadden our Father in heaven. I see many Jews that are homosexual actively promoting it as a normal lifestyle. I see many Jews involved in the ACLU, which I call the Anti-Christian Liberal Union. This bothers me, as how can one be against their father and son in heaven who are for life? I see many Jews in Hollywood making filthy, sinful movies. What happened to the good family movies? I see many Jews full of greed in Hollywood, Wall Street, etc. I see many Jews... Boy, I tell you, this must be like the only Christian who lives in some, you know, Hasidic neighborhood. He just sees Jews. There's Jews everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, I went to a barbecue stand, and there were Jews. It was Jewish barbecue. There's Jews everywhere. Ah! I see many Jews involved in abortion groups. How can one support the killing of human fetuses, especially people who have suffered through the Holocaust? I'm not anti-Semitic. I love that you got to get it's two-thirds of the way through the paragraph of anti-Semitism before you get to I'm not anti-Semitic. I know many will come on here and attack me. I'm simply stating what I see, and I believe our Father in heaven is wondering what is happening to His chosen people. He sent His only Son to earth to die for our sins, and I think He's wondering the direction our country's taking? ? I am praying for our country and all the Jews in our country, and pray that our Father will forgive us for our sins. I'm sure that, oddly enough, just taking from the tenor of this note, I'm pretty sure that that prayer doesn't include, Dear Father, please forgive me for actively advocating for the senseless slaughter of a million Iraqi civilians, or the anonymous hellfire missiling of various and sundry innocent Afghan wedding parties. No, that's not part of the prayer of the forgiveness. No, sorry. I'm praying for our country and all the Jews in our country. Dear Jesus, please help all the Jews. And all the Jews in our country, and pray that our Father will forgive us all for our sins. I hope I have stated what God would have wanted me to say. God bless and pray for our country. And then this about Elie Wiesel. Old man should go away. Old man should go away. Whew. I know. So again, maybe that's the theme that, that sort of evolves and develops through the course of this evening. What's real ought not be. And what ought not be is. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
I heard a good other name for Fox News on Washington Journal this morning.
Oh, did you really?
I mean, you may have heard it, but I haven't, but I thought it was great. The White Power Network.
That's about the size of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was a great name. Didn't you? Don't you? White Power Network.
We're Fox, your White Power, your White Power News Authority.
Yeah. And I had a thing that I got in behind. I was at the drugstore today, and I went up to stand in line, and there was looked like a fairly young guy, big husky guy, in front of me, and he and this woman was talking. When I got up there, I realized they were talking about the health care plan. And she went on, and he was saying, they were kind of talking to one another. She was still talking to him on the way out. And he said, yeah, we ought to be able to vote for that, this trying to cram it down our throats. And then he said, well, I know one thing. He's not going to be a second term if he lives that long.
Who?
They just say what they want to say, don't they?
Oh, yeah, they do. They absolutely do. And it's scary as heck.
I thought, in a way, I thought, maybe I'll get his tag number and report him.
Well, that's like that freakazoid Karl Rove on Fox today.
Oh, gosh.
He was having an on-air hissy fit, namely this particular hissy fit. Hang on, I'll get it rolling here just a second.
Carl, also during this Asian trip, the President of the United States had a very deep bow toward the Emperor of Japan. You know, this is a long-standing precedent going back to the founding of the Republic. American presidents don't bow to anybody, but the president, there he is bowing. He bowed to King Abdullah earlier in the year as well. The administration said, look, it's just protocol. It's one of those things they do. You've been in an administration where a president has faced, there's Abdullah right there, it's going down. Why doesn't the, when you look at this, what do you think?
I think it was inappropriate. Look, you may, you know, a slight nod of the head perhaps to the Japanese emperor, though, you know, what's that all about? I mean, he's not even the head of state. You know, but that deep bow from the waist, actually in the Japanese culture, bespeaks weakness. And look, the President of the United States simply can't get it right. I mean, it's a worldwide apology tour. We're sorry, we're wrong. And oh, incidentally, I'm going to bow deeply to the waist to, you know, the once divine Japanese, you know, Japanese monarchy. I just don't get it. I mean, in England, they didn't bow, but they bow there. They bow to the Saudi, mm-hmm. but, you know, will they bow to the king?
Do you just hate Karl Rove or what, Juanita? And I know you don't have hate in your heart, but...
No, you know, I've been thinking about that lately. I've been rethinking that.
You know, the funny thing is that Karl Rove knows little or nothing about American history. Because early on, I'm trying to think, I forget if it was Jefferson or George Washington who didn't think much of handshaking. And he just wanted a nice, crisp little bow at the waist, like, because, what, maybe George Washington was credited as having invented the handshake or something, but the nerve of Karl Rove to complain about how the President of the United States behaves with respect to the leader of another country when he, pardon me, I'm not trying to be crass, but George did everything but give the tongue to the King of Saudi Arabia. You know what I mean? Holy cow!
Well, I saw another version of that on MSNBC, I believe, at least the people that were commentating did bring up that George Bush about him kissing the, the Emirate or whatever.
The King of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And they showed it too. And, but I thought, well, my gosh, you know, first it was the hamburgers, or maybe it was not the first. Remember, they had never heard of Have It Your Way, I guess. But of all things to talk about this now.
But, you know, if they caught Obama making a ham sandwich, Juanita, there'd be something wrong with it. These people are pathetic.
Of course. Well, I can't win for losing, that's for sure. But for Karl Rove needs to shut his trap because...
Well, Karl Rove needs to be standing in a dock facing charges in The Hague.
That's
exactly right.
Exactly right. A whole bunch of them, especially him and Cheney and Bush. They should be investigated, publicly investigated. Of course, now they got a thing, you know, about the prisoners from Guantanamo going up to Illinois, you know, to that prison.
Right.
So it's going to be dangerous for Illinois.
Oh, Illinois is just going to catch fire and burn to the ground.
Yeah.
They'll be bombing Walmarts all over the place trying to get...
They interviewed some people there, and... They said they thought it would be good for them, you know, because the economy's really bad, and that it would bring back some economy to them, you know.
Right, but, you know, I kind of reject, I reject the idea of prison economies as being something fundamentally un-American.
Oh, well, that's another
right.
subject, yeah.
And moreover, there's, you know, there's the equally disturbing fact that what the people we're talking about warehousing at this Illinois prison, Juanita,
yeah.
may not, I mean, it's like something out of what Mr. Chi was talking about earlier in the program, just yeah. sticking somebody in prison without charges and never letting them go. That there is, yeah. you know, you can see the story at your SDP.org of someone who was a member of the Singaporean legislature who has simply been held in prison without charges for 27 years.
Oh, Lord.
Who's 82 years old. And what we're talking about doing is using that prison in Illinois as a warehousing facility for people who have never been charged.
Well, they want them to stay down in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're saying they're fussing about having trials in New York City. But it's funny to me how they say they should be tried by the military. Yet, that was their excuse not to give them the Geneva Convention handling because they weren't really military. So, I mean, it's crazy. That's their kind of crazy thinking.
Well, it isn't logical, Juanita, and I think maybe the best way to describe it is to say that it is circular thinking. Because on the one hand, you know, I was clicking by because it's the only daggum news channel I get. And on my way back from ESPN, where the sporting world was having a fit over a coaching call on fourth down last night in the Patriots Colts game, I happened by Fox News just in time to hear someone say, "Well, those people captured that are at Guantanamo, they're enemy combatants, just like the people who bombed Pearl Harbor." But of course, that's not true.
No.
Because enemy combatant is a newish term, and enemy combatant was not the designation for people that we captured in the course of the Second World War. The definition of people we captured in the Second World War was prisoner of war. And the Bush administration hair-lit hell trying to keep from calling the people they captured prisoners of war, and that's how they came up with that Orwellian bit of nonsense, enemy combatant.
It's just, you know, the whole thing is just crazy as a bed bug.
It is.
Did you know that, so speaking of crazy, and that's an insult to crazy people, but Glenn Beck, speaking of that,
yeah.
did you know South Park has got a thing on him now?
Oh, I've seen it.
Have you?
Yes.
I got to see it.
Yeah, it's... I'll have to look and see if I can find it. David in Tennessee sent that along, and that was and they, you know, just like Jon Stewart did, South Park nailed him too.
Yeah, I love Jon Stewart too, and he's the one that exposed Fox News about that slicing those people together.
Right, that was the film footage of the rallies.
It was just like the trees suddenly had gold leaves, and then they were green.
You just can't beat this. You can't beat this bunch. Well, I mean, you know, look, let's make sure. You know, I sort of issued a little bit of an indictment of Virginia Senator Jim Webb earlier in the program, talking about him co-sponsoring this. Let's make sure that mentally damaged people get guns bill, mentally damaged veterans get guns, with Burr of North Carolina, the Repiglican. And he's wrong on another one, too. He doesn't want anybody tried in given a fair trial. He doesn't want anybody from Guantanamo to be given a fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
He said this: "I have never disputed the constitutional authority of the president to convene Article III courts in cases of international terrorism. However, I remain very concerned about the wisdom of doing so. Those who have committed acts of international terrorism are enemy combatants just as certainly as the Japanese pilots who killed thousands of Americans at Pearl Harbor. It will be disruptive, costly, and potentially counterproductive to try them as criminals in our civilian courts. The precedent set by this decision deserves careful scrutiny as we consider it proper venues for trying those now held at Guantanamo who were apprehended outside of this country for acts that occurred outside of the country. And we must be especially careful with any decision to bring onto American soil any of those prisoners who remain a threat to our country but whose cases have been adjudged as inappropriate for trial at all. They do not belong in our country, they do not belong in our courts, and they do not belong in our prisons. I have consistently argued that military commissions, with the additional procedural rules added by Congress and enacted by President Obama, are the most appropriate venue for trying individuals adjudged to be enemy combatants. Enemy combatants.
Yeah.
Is a made-up bunch of baloney.
Yeah. Well, I don't agree.
You don't agree with me or with Webb?
I don't agree with Webb.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, he's right. No, And that's that Pearl Harbor thing. They were enemy soldiers. They were enemy pilots.
Right.
They were enemy sailors.
I mean, you didn't have to have a trial to prove that.
No.
I mean, I was watching some World War footage last night, and I've got some good ones on History Channel. And anyway... That, you know, they definitely, I mean, we hardly had any fleet to fight with. Like I said, you had six carriers.
Three.
And they were like old.
Yeah, we had three. The Yorktown, the Enterprise, and the, or maybe the Enterprise, Hornet, and Wasp. We had three carriers in the Pacific. And they all happened to be out on patrol, out at sea at the time that Pearl Harbor happened, but they got all of our old battle wagons and old destroyers and old cruisers and, you know.
And everything that could, yeah, because most of the stuff was going to Europe. But I remember you telling about your uncle that died over in the Pacific. I always remember that story.
I had an uncle. I had an uncle and a great uncle. No, an uncle.
The
and,
one you said that he had a small wound. We were talking about.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was yeah. That was my father's brother. Yes.
Yeah, the great. Remember.
Mm-hmm.
Those band-aids they had at the Republican convention.
Oh yeah, the Purple Heart band-aids.
Yeah, and yeah. I was talking to you about. You know, just a tiny wound, you can bleed to death from it. Just a little teeny one. You just hit a bleeder. And you said that if they'd have had some kind of, maybe like penicillin, I don't know if that penicillin.
Right, well, all the, yeah.
Whatever, so.
All the penicillin was with the the forces marching from Normandy eastward, whereas my uncle was on I guess it was a diversionary invasion in the south of France. And they got no penicillin, and I got no uncle.
Yeah. And, you know, about them making fun of, you know, the little wounds. And I thought, well, they're laughing at something. They don't have any comprehension of that.